Earn your JD from UNH Franklin Pierce School of Law and join the powerhouse in legal education. Now accepting applications. A top 100 law school ranked 5th for intellectual property law. Apply today at law.unh.edu. Do we intend to keep our republic? That's the question Rubin Center Director John Graby discusses in his latest Constitutional Connections article and here. This is the UNH Law Podcast. Learn more about the law school and apply by visiting law.unh.edu. Opinions discussed are solely the opinion of the faculty or host and do not constitute legal advice or necessarily represent the official views of the University of New Hampshire. So, John, you wrote a surprisingly strong-worded article this week in the Concord Monitor. What drove you to talk about this topic?
Well, I mean, I think we're coming off of, a really historically significant event, the impeachment of President Trump on two articles of impeachment by the House of Representatives, but then the decision by the Senate to acquit the president without taking evidence or hearing from additional witnesses. Historians tell us this is actually the first time that impeachment has been tried without additional evidence such as that. I think one struggles. I especially in my role as a teacher of constitutional law and as a director of a nonpartisan center here at the law school, I feel my view is to sort of expose my students and others to sort of the wide range of perspectives and to be more explanatory, most of the time. But there comes a time, I think, where mere description is almost misleading. I mean, I think what happened during the Senate trial, and I don't want to frame this in partisan terms, but I think what happened during the Senate trial was really a wholesale abdication of one branch of government that is supposed to be co-equal and is supposed to be, under our constitutional design, exercising checks and balances on the president. I think the reason for it is obvious. It's that partisanship is a stronger pull than loyalty to the institution one serves right now. But it has real consequences. I think we've seen those consequences in the week or so since the acquittal took place, where the president has taken action against people who, testified to the House, where the president seemingly has interfered with a criminal prosecution of somebody with whom he was alleged to have, had a relationship, Roger Stone. As a descriptive matter, if this going forward is going to be all within the prerogatives of the President of the United States, well, then we really do have a different sort of constitutional order than the one I think most of us would have said we adopted back, when we adopted the Constitution.
Yeah, the framers are very specific. I mean, there were supposed to be three co-equal branches that checks and balances to make sure everyone's doing what they're supposed to and not overstepping, because they're afraid of a monarchy, essentially.
Yeah, they were. I mean, actually, at the time, they were more afraid, interestingly, of the legislature, because the most recent experience that led up to the Constitutional Convention was, in their view, runaway and rogue state legislatures that weren't properly respecting individual rights such as property
rights.
They
want another revolution to start immediately after the first one stopped.
That's true. But, but on the other hand, of course, the revolution was a revolt against a system of government a monarchy, right? Mm-hmm. The Constitution was by design a document that sought to distribute power horizontally into three branches of the federal government, vertically between the federal government and the states. It also then carved out little zones of freedom known as individual rights, where no government can intrude. And written into the Constitution are a series of additional measures that allow the various branches to check and balance each other. I mean, the president has the right to veto legislation, but then the legislature has the right to override the veto if you can get a supermajority. Impeachment and removal is one of the principal checks and balances by which Congress can put the brakes on a rogue executive. To many people, what is happening right now is what we're seeing right now is a rogue executive, a president who is not following longstanding norms and does not seem to understand himself to be constrained by what we would describe as the rule of law.
Which is what we talked about in last month's podcast when we discussed the one of the two articles of impeachment, which is
if you are called by Congress, you're supposed to follow that subpoena and answer their questioning, things like that, and that not necessarily the judicial branch is supposed to step in. They're supposed to respect the authority of Congress.
Yeah, ironically, the arguments being made, you know, the argument made to Congress was you're going too fast with impeachment. You should go to court if you think you're entitled to this information. But then in court, the president's the executive branch officials' lawyers were actually arguing that the courts have no business being involved. So it was quite literally a catch-22. Yeah. And really, actually, even the first article of impeachment also can be seen as, you know, treading on the prerogatives of Congress. This was an appropriation of money to an ally that there is bipartisan agreement is an important ally in terms of standing up to, you know, Russia, which is, you know, one of our if not our principal foreign adversary. And so when the Congress appropriates money, the understanding is that the executive makes sure that that money gets to that ally. And so you might even think of the first article of impeachment as sort of a disrespect of the judgment of Congress.
Now, what are the implications, in your opinion, from constitutional perspective of this continuing?
Well, you know, we may be at a point where we're reaching the outermost constitutional firewall. We are privileged in this country now that the vote is widespread. It was not the case when the Constitution was first created. There was a very, very narrow subset of people who were understood to be entitled to vote, excluded women, excluded the slaves at the time. By hard experience, we have extended that franchise over the last couple hundred years. And we have an election coming up in November. And ultimately, the Constitution emanates from we the people, the first three words of the document. As James Madison put it in one of his essays that we now call the Federalist Papers, he acknowledged that power always seeks to try to encroach, you know, that power abhors a vacuum. And the Constitution has certain checks and balances that are written into it, that are on paper. But without the superintendence by the people, without vigilance by the people, as he put it, parchment barriers, okay, so limits written into the document, those won't hold. And ultimately, I think it's really now fair to say it's up to us to decide, you know, do we want to see our constitutional order transform into a very different sort of government than the one we've had so far. You know, to go back to the story that everybody's telling, you know, the famous story about Ben Franklin on the last day of the Constitutional Convention. Somebody goes up and says, you know, what have you done? What have you created, a republic or a monarchy? And he says, a republic, if you can keep it. I mean, I think it may not be an exaggeration to say that this fall's election will be a referendum on whether we intend to keep our republic.
Mm-hmm. And it's also kind of an issue with it where there's no strong leaders on the other side to kind of go up against such a strong, very self-interested president that the whole Republican Party has just fallen in line with. So there's no check and balance even within the Republican Party against Trump.
I mean, yeah, partisanship is the name, you know, partisanship is what's driving things. It's not these institutional limits and checks. And, you know, some people are wondering whether, you know, somebody, a billionaire, you know, Mike Bloomberg is jumping in right now. You know, some would say that it is underscoring the danger that we're in, that somebody could just buy their way into a race for the presidency such as this. You know, and so we'll see what happens. Others would say, though, it seems as though Bloomberg is jumping in with the argument that he wants to restore the republic, you know, that we had to the extent that we might be seen to be losing it. You know, it's just to sum it up, it's not what the framers would have liked to see develop.
Did they talk about the risks of the partisanship when they were working on the Constitution that they are aware of?
Well, yeah, they talked about trying to mitigate the negative effects of what they called faction. Mm-hmm. And I think the partisanship, through political parties that we're seeing today is sort of a paradigmatic example of the sort of faction that they were trying to design the government to be able to be resistant to, so that one faction wouldn't take over government and then sort of disregard norms. Parties emerged right away. I don't know that they fully anticipated the form that partisanship would take, and it happened quite quickly. And that first decade of the nation's existence was absolutely as partisan as what we're seeing right now. I mean, we saw there were federal statutes enacted during that decade called the Alien and Sedition Acts that were used by the party in power, the Federalists, to actually put their political opponents in jail. this is not unprecedented. But I do think it's fair to say that the framers would be surprised to see how enduring and the gravitational pull that partisanship has really exercised through almost all of American history.
And it's definitely been exacerbated the last couple decades by cable news, 24-hour news cycle, or 2-hour news cycle. Things turn over so quickly, especially social media over the last 10 years. I mean, that's been a huge tool of the Trump presidency.
Yeah. I mean, there were incredibly partisan newspapers in existence at the time of the founding, but they weren't so available in such a widespread way. And, it's always been the case that one can go find their news from sources that are going to reinforce their views. Mm-hmm. But the pervasiveness right now is of course, a relatively new phenomenon.
Thanks for listening to the UNH Law Podcast. Be sure to comment and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify. See you next Thursday. Join the powerhouse for legal education. Earn your JD, LLM, master's degree, or certificate from a top 100 law school. Residential and online programs available. Now accepting applications at law.unh.edu.